How do you write on the computer or
notebook? Yeah, I have a little notebook computer. Hmm. I can take it in a room or whatever and just sit down and write. So yeah, how do you do it? How do you write?
I usually write in this notebook.
You do? So you write by hand?
Yeah. I just find that the computer seems like an official to me, almost like I have to pass, like, it's almost like the boss of my life.
You feel like you have to have something structured before you sit down and type?
A little bit, or that I'm not as at ease. So if I have to write something, I mean, I do that with public radio things as well. I'll write all the good thoughts that I come up with, or the things I think are good thoughts, the bits of writing that I like, the way that I think it should go, or things, points of interest I discover in just the messiness of writing.
Do you, are you kind of an outliner a little bit as an idea notebook? I know that's a pretty common thing with writers where you kind of carry something around, you make little notes and little outlines.
Probably someone would call it an outline. But I don't think you could lift it out and go, there's solid thought here.
Mm-hmm.
because it's mostly, I think I'm too simple. I would love to be an outliner. And I think some people have great organizational brains and they can really think things out. I think those, they could build something.
If those, I'm gonna, it's like those damn productive people. That's what it is. It's those damn productives.
Well, they're so organized and they're always getting things done. And it drives me nuts. And they already know. They know beforehand what they're going to do, and then they do it, and it's exactly what they said. Yeah. And that they're done, and they're on to the next project.
I hate the successful, don't you? They're so productive.
Why don't they just stop and relax for a second and just, I mean, this extends to every aspect. So if I'm going to make something, like you're making that skating rink, I'm going to start with a couple boards that I hit together, and then I'm going to go, okay, should I put some plastic down? What do real fathers do if they're making skating rinks for their children?
I've done this for several years, and I haven't documented it at all. And this is my third year of building a rink, and I keep thinking every year, oh, I should write up a piece about this. Because, yeah, that's something I could sell.
Yeah.
But it's also like a step-by-step. I've written about it before, in a comical way. But I haven't written an actual, how do you do it?
Is there a step-by-step?
Yeah, it's a simple thing. I mean, you're building a giant wading pool and you're freezing it. I mean, that's really what you're doing.
Sounds easy, but I know that I would be...
Well, if the weather cooperates, it is very easy to build a little backyard ice rink. But I just thought it'd be fun to write up a kind of a how-to manual kind of a thing.
Right.
And I sold the piece this year on kind of a comical take on what happened last year, because last year was very mild and it turned to be a big, muddy, wading pool where the dogs just kind of ran through.
Was that for New Hampshire Magazine?
Yeah, it was a New Hampshire Magazine piece, which was great and was fun, but I wanted to, I kind of just thought I'd document it with some pictures about, okay, how do you, step one, you got to look for a good place to put it in the yard, and then how you put the boards together, and then what you use for a good liner, and tips to maintain it. Just kind of a fun how-to article for something fun to do in the backyard with the kids. And so I started writing that down. But see, I'm so unorganized, I didn't think to do that in the fall when I was building it. I'm doing it in the middle of January when it's 10 degrees out. It's already built and frozen, and everything's covered up in snow. Like, I think, oh, this is a good time to write about it. So nobody's going to be able to use it. It's not practical advice at this time of year. But I think we were talking about this before, you and I, because we both try to write pieces for publication. And being kind of radio people, it's very immediate. And when you're writing for a publication, especially not a newspaper or magazine, you have to write months in advance.
Right.
So if you're writing anything that has any kind of seasonal topic to it, you've got to plan 6, 8, or 12 months in advance.
I don't like that.
And for unorganized people like you and me,
the way that, and I also don't understand, you have to get the article in many months beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Usually like three now with New Hampshire Magazine. It used to be a little closer, but they're trying to run a tighter ship.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure why exactly it is that way, because they do change that text right up to the last minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't ever understand. I think it's because they want to see the layout. And it's mostly most of the magazine work. It seems like most of the care about the magazine is about the way it lays out.
I would think so.
What the images are.
Yeah. I think the aesthetic look is what attracts people initially to it. And the content is almost, not, I wouldn't say secondary, but it's got to be in a pleasing fashion.
But it is a sad, not primary part of it. I think that's one thing that I always like to, because I know that my part, my piece, the thing that, and it's also the hardest piece, I think, to put together, at least time-wise. I mean, you have to have certain talents and skills to do the pictures and to do the layouts and stuff. But the guy who's doing the writing part, they're just laboring, you know, for like a few weeks over it. Everybody else is kind of just, you know, sits down and goes, picture here, there. I'm making their job seem really easy.
Well, I think they have to make sure that the advertisers are happy with the layout, because the advertiser is going to be, you know, is the paying customer here. And you know, that ad, I bought that quarter page and I want it to be in the best content of the magazine. And I want it to, when I open it up, I want it to be very easy to see. And I want it to be pleasing to attract the eye to it, to the ad. I mean, that's, so I think that's probably a primary mover, a primary motivator.
I think that's so weird because I never had before thought of the magazine primarily as a visual medium.
Mm-hmm.
But in some weird way, it almost is more of a visual medium than it is a reading or a, I mean, if you get the New Yorker, that's a pretty text-heavy magazine. But if you get like any of those
any glossy,
big, fat, glossy magazines, you're just flipping through that, absorbing image after image after image, smelling all the great perfume samples. I still will smell those.
I can't stand those. Really?
You know what it is? I think even though I'll never wear it, I would love to find the fragrance that defines me. You know, I sort of like, if I ever went to Wall Street, this is what I would wear. Like, I would love to find my alter ego, Gordon Gekko, man, Armani scent.
See, there's a guy that lives in New Hampshire. Do you need a scent? Do you need, I mean, pine tree and maple syrup. I mean, I don't know. Do we need, like...
This is a great idea. Cologne for the backwoods gentleman. Because we don't, it should be not that expensive, and it doesn't need to smell like money.
It's Shed for the Coos County girl.
Yeah. Shed.
Shed. I did a spoof on that years ago at my old radio station, and it was called Shed, the scent for the Coos County girl. Do people that live out in the country, do the backwoods, you know, like, what would be the perfume for them?
Well, you know, a big one, and this is just a, you know, via relatives, I would say Stetson for men. You know, kind of like the colognes or perfumes that you could get at Marshall's that are just like kind of up front.
The kind of standard issue.
Yeah, like perfume,
lower price.
Popular perfumes from a decade ago that have kind of fallen off. Yves Saint Laurent. Things that may, I don't even know if Yves Saint Laurent is.
I don't even know what that is.
Pierre Cardin. Yeah.
Oh, I have heard that.
You know, and then you can go get a shirt. So like Marshall's, they'll have, you can get a shirt and then you can get the cologne and it's kind of like you're matching.
It's amazing that scent,
hard when you talk about fragrances.
That they invoke so much. Even that when you say like, because I remember, when you smell someone still wearing an older scent like that, it takes you right back to the first person that you associate with that.
Oh,
scent.
Exactly. I have.
There's an old girlfriend, or you know, your uncle who wore the Stetson, or you know, whatever.
Right.
You know.
I have. Every once in a while, I'll smell this sort of. This antique rose milk scent, which was the perfume that my kindergarten teacher wore. At least in memory, that's what I've attached this scent to her. I don't know if it's really true, but I believe it. And I smell it maybe once or twice a year, and I'll just kind of spin around thinking, is, you know, Miss Kelly here?
Yeah, it's funny how your brain will take you right back to that. The smell, I think, does that more than any other sense, you know. If you meet somebody that has that perfume or that fragrance, do you feel a little more? Is your first impression stronger because of that? because you associate them with someone that you liked back at the time that had a strong association for you?
I mean, usually it's a warm, like if somebody smells like something I'm familiar with, mm-hmm. I think I feel a little warmer toward them, or like I know them a little, even if it's a smell I don't like much, like Drakkar Noir or Axe. Or, you know, sort of like the over-the-counter teenage boys.
Yeah, when I smell that stuff, I'm thinking instantly, you know, kid, baggy jeans, way just marinated in the stuff because he thinks for some reason this is going to get him some action. Like the 15-year-old boy who thinks like, all right, I will spray every part of my body and clothing with Axe. For some reason, this is what's going to do it for me.
And I don't know if there's any evidence about this, but I think there is some cause and effect, and I think it does help them. Yeah, I think they get a little closer. I'm not saying there's any success with, you know, achieving, getting a girlfriend or whatever, but it might make them more confident. It might be the placebo thing. But I also think that if somebody smells good or smells strongly,
yeah, I don't know if it would be good.
They're putting out a message that's saying I'm interested in this.
Yeah,
and the even just saying that, like if you walked around just going,
it's a big tacky pheromone, is what it is.
It is. That's a really good way.
It's a big tacky pheromone display. It's like holding up a billboard, thinking to me, it's saying desperate enough to repel everybody else but 14-year-old girls.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you walked around all day just saying like a mantra, I would like a girlfriend. I would like a girlfriend. I bet the guy who said that all day, as opposed to the guy who didn't smell like I can't say it anymore, so I won't. I bet he would get closer to getting a girlfriend just from saying it. And I think that's what the strong cologne is saying. It's
maybe, but what kind of a girlfriend would he get?
You know, that's the problem. You know what?
The desperate don't differentiate.
You're fishing with a certain type of bait, and you're going to get a certain kind of fish.
That's true.
This is Rick and Sean's cliche fishing show.
Dating tips with Rick and Sean.
Do you have any dating tips?
I have been sleeping with the same woman since I was 18 years old, so I have nothing to offer.
Did you ever?
did I ever have anything to offer?
I think we got confused there because all of a sudden our minds are imagining you sleeping with someone. But
no,
I mean, do you have any dating tips?
No,
to offer?
I don't.
In the old days, were you a wise man?
I think very few people have anything wise to offer at 18 about dating.
Did you know anybody back then that did have, like, was there a kid in your school who was like the guy who was like, here's what you got to do? Because I didn't have that. I don't know anybody who ever had wisdom.
I don't think anybody quite that, you know, not to that degree. I mean, I remember there was a couple of people, because I hung out with a lot of older people in high school, like 2-3 years older than me. So they were, kind of followed their lead, I guess. I would say, and I dated some older girls in high school, but I don't think here's what you gotta do, you know,
right.
You gotta wear this, you gotta act like that, you gotta, I mean, it wasn't quite, you know.
Why is it that whenever we put on like the wisdom guy, it's always street wisdom?
I don't know.
It's never like,
watch too many movies.
It's never this like thoughtful kid, mm-hmm. You know, we never go, listen, if you want the girls, you've got to do, it's always
this
street
guy. Now, why do you go with
a
British accent?
I was trying to be American.
French?
No, it was nothing. I think we often try to do accents, and they just come off as little strange twists to our voice, but it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing. It's not attached to a country.
I kind of wanted to go back to writing. We got off that tangent about perfume, but because you're talking about you going through magazines, and it's a visual medium. Well, it's a visual world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But the scent, the perfume, is there just as much as the pictures and those glossies to attract.
I think they have to have that smell now. I think that it would be a strange experience for people to open up one of those glossies and just smell like magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they probably have to have two or three at least of those things in there.
But those magazines, like the real the big national glossies, like a Cosmopolitan or whatever, I mean, they're mostly advertising and pictures anyway.
Right.
The content is so secondary. You know, it's so beside the point. I was kind of thinking about writing for a magazine, you know, I haven't written for that kind of a thing. It's much more regional and much more of a local flavor.
You were thinking about writing for like a bigger magazine?
No, but I mean, I wanted to kind of talk about how, like, get back to how you write, because I'm looking at that notebook of yours and I see you've got little short lines.
Yeah.
And it's almost like poetry a bit.
That's just, I tend to write, like, I don't like to write sitting down at a table.
Mm-hmm.
And I write like Roald Dahl. I've never known how to say his name. The children's author?
Yeah.
And only, not like I decided that, you know, I'm going to write like this. Just, I like to sit in a chair with a pillow on my lap or something on my lap and then the notebook on top of that. Or in bed. But that's why it looks like this, because I get to this and the page starts to bend down. The notebook sort of bends over. So I waste all this space.
Mm-hmm.
But then I move through pages quickly. And I often go back and I need the margin to note. So if you look through it all, I'll often write other, sort of annotate my own stuff.
So when you go, when you actually say, okay, I'm going to put something together, I'm going to write something to either record later or for either a piece for radio or for publication, do you go back through all those notes? Is it out of your mind so you can, or in your mind because the paper was used to kind of organize your thoughts in the first place? I mean, what do you use the notebook for? How often do you go back and pull something out?
I don't tend to transcribe too directly out of this.
It's more of kind of a referral?
Or a thought starter. A lot of times if I'm looking for an opening, you know, the opening, and it doesn't even have to be a good opening line for anything, but just a way in, it's kind of like you're trying to find the doorway to the story. And usually if I've got that, then I can go. But I never can find that sort of doorway to the story on the computer. So I start here and I'll write all these different things. A lot of the times, and I don't know why this is, but a lot of the times the radio or the magazine pieces that I'll write will, opening lines or some sort of premise inside it will have arrived separate from the piece. So, and I'll feel really lucky, like I'll be like, wow, I never would have thought of this thought that really relates to this piece that I can use in the piece when I was writing about this other thing, just about my day or something about that Sam did or something about the weather.
You would never associate it otherwise, but it for some reason, because you weren't necessarily bogged down in the minutia of the piece, you were on outside of it.
It's almost like I'm stealing from another thought pattern that I had. And I almost feel like I'm cheating because I'm not inside the sort of bucket of the story. I'm taking something from last week that I wrote as a journal entry, and I'm cutting and pasting into this story about monster trucks. And I sort of feel
you're plagiarizing yourself in a way?
Yeah. I feel a little bit like I wish I could have had that thought, because it takes a certain kind of mind to be able to have that thought inside of monster trucks, to be able to come to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that. I have to steal from myself, like this little, like Dickensian thief with a little bag on a little stick and a sack, and I wander around, and I take things from myself. And that's one of the other things that I like about writing, is that the pure freedom of just being here where I don't think of anything, nothing is matters. It's like a little garden place, like my own little garden that grows strange vegetables. I can't find that, or I can't make that on the computer. It's too, the computer's just too neat. It's, and it is again, like that it's the boss of me. I feel like it's the thing I report to for duty.
So you kind of look at it as the arbiter. It's the final.
Yeah.
It's the final gatekeeper, and you're not free to play on it. You've got to present it and. That's interesting. I think there are a lot of people feel that way, the same way, especially for people who kind of grew up when word processing was still kind of a novelty. Well, it was a big kind of colossal machine that you had to borrow or, you know, go to the library to use or something. So if you did a lot of writing, you know, prior to, say, 20 years ago, you didn't necessarily have a keyboard in front of you other than a typewriter. So I think you got used to doing notebooks and writing and so on. I think for writers now, for people who have kind of grown up in the last 15 or 20 years, I think they're much more comfortable with just kind of playing around with the keys and using a computer or some other device to make notes. And play
I do. I do think that that's true. I mean, I think there are plenty of people out there who, for them, the computer and the keyboard and that interface is mm-hmm. the same as this is for me.
Yeah.
It's really just, I think it's a little bit of a generational type thing. But, you know, like I mentioned last time that I've been reading Kurt Vonnegut's letters.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote all his things on a typewriter. And as far as I know, he didn't really do much jotting down. I mean, he must have done some jotting down in notebooks when there wasn't a typewriter around, but he would compose on the typewriter. And there are plenty of people that did compose, but he was also anti-computer. He called himself a Luddite.
In a lot of ways, the typewriter is the computer.
It is, that's the
aesthetically, it's the same thing.
That's the problem with Ludditism, is like, where do you draw the line?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're always going to, you know, even a pencil is a tool.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the relativism of Ludditism is the important...
Is that a new religion?
I worship at the power of... And the other thing that I learned from Kurt Vonnegut about Ludditism is there actually was a guy, I think his name was Bob Ludd, in England, from which all this sort of anti-technology sentiment kind of grew. And Bob Ludd was a notorious machine breaker back in, you know, when the Industrial Revolution was taking place.
Yeah.
He was one of those guys.
Smash them, right?
Well, he had a job, and I don't know what it was. He would, you know, put this with that and maybe the Iron Forge or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when automation came along, a machine came along to replace him, he broke it. Because if the machine's there, he doesn't have a job anymore. So Ludditism is sort of that. And apparently, back in those days, there were lots of these machine breakers, which I love this idea of these people that break machines.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
And you don't hear much about that.
And they were sentenced to death. These people who would break machines, machine breakers, were killed, were executed. And not in the 10th century. This is like 1860, 1870.
Yeah. Hardcore.
Yeah.
But this was over in Great Britain?
Yeah.
Or Europe, yeah.
In England, yeah. But probably wherever machines were taking over, where the machines were taking over. This is like Terminator Zero, when the machines mm-hmm. were looms. And Arnold Schwarzenegger looked like a loom.
That's funny. That's interesting. I kind of know a little bit about that story, but I didn't realize it was a real undercurrent, a real trend of people doing it.
Yeah, and so Bob Ludd. And you don't have to be a machine breaker to... I think that we all are Luddites to a certain extent, where at a certain point we're going to stop adopting new technologies, or we don't want any more machines. You know, we're like, I've had machine enough. I can deal with a blender and a toaster and a computer and a phone.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to mechanize or motorize or automate anything above that, I don't want to be invited.
Yeah, there's a natural curve, learning curve, I think, and a natural kind of... bell curve to the age like that, where you're most prone to adopting things at, you know, age 25 or whatever it is. And I think there's a gradual runoff for most people, just like there is for music or literature or any art appreciation. I think that you get set into a certain pattern as you get older. I was kind of had a question for you. I wanted to go back and ask you more about...
Did you forget it?
Writing, and I completely forgot about it.
While you're thinking about that, I'll make one more comment about the typewriter.
Okay.
Do you know what the first book ever written on the typewriter was?
I don't know. No.
I didn't know either. It was just another gift of Kurt Vonnegut's. It was Huckleberry Finn. Mark Twain wrote it on a typewriter.
Was it really?
Yeah, it's
really?
The first novel ever.
I think I may have heard of that before, but it doesn't... necessarily. I say that because I toured Mark Twain's Connecticut house years ago, which is very fascinating. If you're a Mark Twain fan and you want to kind of see, kind of get a real sense of how he lived there, you can see his daughters. You can see the whole way it's set up is so.
You could see like the room where he would be and imagine him walking out to the kitchen.
His third floor. Kind of his bachelor's room where he had his pool table and he wrote and he had his desk and they have one of his typewriters. They have the telephone, the one telephone, one of the first telephones installed in that in that town, and you can kind of see, you really get a real sense of place and a real sense of Mark Twain there. His bed is there, that big kind of bed that.
Oh yeah.
And you, the whole thing is just amazing.
Well, he was the very pro technology. I mean,
he was.
He did a lot of.
He lost a lot of money in some automation. Remember, he invested in
some kind of typesetting.
Yeah, it was a typesetting equipment for newspapers and publishing houses around the world. And he lost. It never really got perfected, and so nobody really wanted to buy it because it was just a cumbersome, expensive machine that would break down constantly.
But he almost made a fortune because it was a really good idea, excellently
executed.
It was
probably 20 years too early,
right?
You know, but he lost a good deal of money, and it ultimately they closed down their Connecticut house for it, and he ended up, you know, going around the world and all that because it was cheaper to live abroad. But I think he made all his money back on the lecture circuit eventually. But
right,
Mark Twain is such a sad American story in that
I was feeling sad, and I'm frustrated
because he lost his two of his daughters die in his lifetime. Yeah. He lost his wife. I mean, to me, the Mark Twain story is so fascinating and so depressing at the end.
Well, I think there's so much buoyancy in his novels
mm-hmm.
that it's hard to stand the fact that his life was so sort of upsetting.
Mm-hmm.
The grief portion of his life as separated.
But to me, because he attained such heights
and
then lost it again. To have it and then to have lost it, for some reason, to me, is more compelling. I don't know why, because you would say, well, isn't it, can't you celebrate the fact that he did attain such heights and did so well? But he was so, I think, ultimately lonely at the end. Why is that true about so many writers and artists?
Well, it may be that we know that they were because they tell us. And because that's what their job is.
Maybe.
And
yeah,
maybe
that's a good point.
A lot of people are, but those people don't
have a voice.
Yeah. Maybe just at the end, you know, they're just. I just think that's probably a common. It's just a miserable topic. How sad will you be?
We're just going to shuffle off this mortal coil as miserable, miserable entities.
Well, shuffling
that's all
sounds,
we are.
That sounds fun at this point. It just more sounds like this. You're almost too sad
to
cry.
We all just fade away into obscurity and oblivion. Yeah. And. Well, you said you had some questions for me, so.
Yeah, I did.
So you want to move on from
questions. Questions.
We're in the question and answer period.
Yeah. Let me see if I. Okay. Here's a true or false question first. And this information came to me via Facebook.
This isn't truth or dare, is it?
No, truth.
Oh, okay. All right.
Truth or falsity.
Checking. All right.
So Christina San Antonio, who listens to the show. If we can say that we have,
do we have a show?
Say it like that. Yes,
this,
the show.
This is a show.
So far, we're calling it the Lamplighters.
I like that. Do you like that, or did you like the two friendly gentlemen from Earth?
No. Well, that was more of a joke.
I
didn't know what, you know. That was more a name that suggested we don't know what the name is.
Right.
Like it's either this or it's this ridiculous name that it can't be a name. Thus, these people don't know what they're called yet. So this, Christina posted something on her Facebook, and that could be information, valuable information for you and your determination, whether this is true or false.
Okay.
About pea shooters. Have you ever heard of pea shooters?
Pea shooters isn't like a slingshot kind of a thing?
We were sort of like talking about the early days before about machine breakers. It's from the machine breakers time.
Okay, all right.
So in the old days, back before clocks and alarm clocks and anything like that, factories and other business establishments who had large amounts of workers would hire, usually women, sometimes men, to go around with pea shooters early in the morning to wake up their employees. So they would shoot peas through these long straws at windows to wake up employees. And they would stand outside the window shooting little stones or whatever they shot until the person would get up.
So you're asking me if this is true?
True or false? And maybe I'm tricking you with the idea that it was posted on my Facebook. Cause this is sort of like The Princess Bride, where there was the section where...
I never saw The Princess Bride.
You didn't see The
Princess Bride? I say that, and people look at me like, you're un-American.
You would love it.
Your
kids would love it, too. You should see it as a family-type movie.
I will do that some night.
It's got its own magical sense of humor. It will make you laugh very hard. But there's one sequence in it, which I don't know. Since you don't know about it, I won't say it. But it's between two strong intellects, and one of them, and they're sort of engaged in this mental combat. One glass before them has been poisoned by one of them. And the other guy has to figure out, based on what he knows about the other guy, whether the one in front of him is poisoned or the one is not. And then at the end, when he decides, they're both going to drink and one of them will die.
All right. Where is the poison? The battle of wits has begun. It ends when you decide and we both drink and find out who is right and who is dead.
But it's so simple. All I have to do is divine from what I know of you. Are you the sort of man who would put the poison into his own goblet or his enemies? Now, a clever man would put the poison into his own goblet because he would know that only a great fool would reach for what he was given. I'm not a great fool, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you. But you must have known I was not a great fool. You would have counted on it, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of me.
You've made your decision then?
Not remotely. Because Iocane comes from Australia, as everyone knows. And Australia is entirely peopled with criminals. And criminals are used to having people not trust them, as you are not trusted by me, so I can clearly not choose the wine in front of you.
Truly, you have a dizzying intellect.
Wait till I get going!
So it's sort of like what I'm suggesting is that giving you the Facebook information, saying that it was posted, is that going to make you think, or am I tricking you? So these true or falses are going to be like double reverse or even triple or quadruple reverse psychology. Uh-huh. Pea shooters.
And I can't Google.
No, of course not. How fun would that be?
Yeah. I guess because it was posted, now did she post it as a question?
I'm lying. That's what I mean.
Well, if there's no premise for you to base my decision on.
I mean, I could say
if
this.
The whole thing is concocted, then.
No, it could be concocted.
But there's no basis for me. There's no foundation for me to make an informed decision.
You have to guess based on your sense of the world.
Did she or did she not?
It's not. That's not the question. I could say this to you. Last night I was reading this new book by Tim Hill on pea shooters. And what he said was there were these people, but maybe I'm making the whole thing up to try to trick.
See, I've never heard of it, so I'm gonna say false.
It is true. There are pea shooters, and they would go along and they would shoot. I don't know if it was actually peas, but there's little things to knock against the window.
Wouldn't they just knock on the door? Why not just knock or shout? Get everybody out of the dormitories. Get your asses into the factory. Like what was the premise of taking the time to shoot little rocks at windows?
I think they determined that it was a lot funner. So if they're going to wake people up...
Didn't they break a lot of glass or...
No, not the way they... Right. These were experts. These were people who could shoot the pee off
of
your
top of
your head.
It seems to me you could hire somebody more cheaply just to knock on the door.
Right.
And yell, get up.
Well, you know, if you want to go back and tell them all that this pee shooting is...
They don't know what they're doing. I'm going to go back and tell them... You're crazy.
Right. Well, but isn't it amazing, though?
I reject this whole argument based on they shouldn't have done it.
So you're saying this should be false.
It should be false. I demand satisfaction.
I think you just want to be right. And so you're trying to make this whole thing seem outlandish.
That is amazing. I did not know that. So Christine, you've taught me something.
Christine often posts these kind. She posts interesting words.
I'm gonna have to check more. Check out more of Christine's posts.
Strange photos, and they're always very captivating.
Hmm.
And that was one of them. And what I find it really interesting too is that this really cool, bizarre, semi-primitive activity is completely forgotten. You know, like, it feels like we should all know about pea shooters because it's so fun that,
right.
that there are these people blowing stones at windows and waking people up. But, you know, before alarm clocks, is that why? I mean, didn't they have clocks back then?
I would think so. I don't know if maybe, depending on what century we're talking about, maybe they... But I think anything that would have a large number of employees would be after the Industrial Revolution, but everyone would have a clock. Because I would imagine pre-1800, it was fairly expensive to buy a good clock, right? Because the clockworks were intricate, hand-built things.
They must have been really expensive
yeah.
little deals.
But I would think by the time the Industrial Revolution happened and you had large factories, it would be pretty common for everybody to have one.
But this must right? have been some moment in time just prior to that. You know, it's sort of Industrial Revolution kicks up, but clocks and alarm clocks are just out of reach in terms of expense. But you still have to get to work by 7 a.m. And most of these guys were drunk the night before. That was the problem.
That's true. Yeah.
Is to wake them, to rouse them from their sousing mm-hmm. so that they go back and very soon in their lives begin to break machines because their jobs were done.
Right.
So pea shooters and machine breakers, hand in hand. I love that.
Have your next title.
Right.
For a podcast, pea shooters and machine breakers.
Just the idea of these ladies like shooting peas.
Sounds like
up.
A steampunk novel, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Pea shooters and machine breakers.
See, we could call ourselves that.
That's not a bad title.
The machine breakers. It's a little long though.
Either that or it's a hair band album. I'm thinking maybe hair band album. Pea shooters. Machine breakers.
What's your favorite hair band? And what's your favorite hair band song?
What was
song?
My favorite hair band? See, I hated hair bands at the time, but I have a new appreciation as I age. My favorite hair band. Well, keeping with the steampunk aesthetic, I kind of like that band Tesla. I thought they weren't too bad.
I wanted to mention this before I do my questions. I got a record player the mm-hmm. other day. My dad was going to throw it away. He's been threatening to throw it away for about 2 months. And he keeps asking me if I want it. I keep saying, no. But he finally stuck it in the trash barrel. And I was over there. We went over. And it was just sitting on top of the trash barrel, on top of the trash, this record player.
Did it call to you?
And right as we were leaving... And it was cold and it was dark. The garage was open. And I looked in there and I went and I grabbed it. And the cord was all hard and wouldn't move because it was frozen solid. Mm-hmm. And I put it in the back of the car and I took it home. And I realized I don't have a single record anywhere. And so now I have this record player. And I think that's why I didn't take it originally. But then I forgot at that last moment. And then I was thinking about my albums and I forgot that I no longer own them. I don't even know where they've gone. But I mean, you are sort of a, you have a record player or even two.
I do.
Still have records.
I do.
Do you still play them?
Every once in a while. Yeah, it's rare, but I do.
And is it, when you do it, is it sort of like, is it like you light a candle, send some incense?
It's a momentous event, yeah.
Yeah, is it a, I mean, are you
sit
just
back
like,
in my bean bag?
Well, are you kind of like, oh, I want to listen to Outlandos de Moore, and so I'll put the record on.
Yeah.
Or are you like, you know what, I really want to listen to a record, so I'm going to put a record on, and it's sort of formal.
Yeah, I mean, I think because most of the records that I have, I don't have another format. Some of them I do. And it's funny because the only place I could listen to them would be in this one room of the house, which is kind of off the beaten path. And it would have to be an event. It's not like something I put down in the background while I, you know, making dinner or something.
Right.
So
it's like you're reading a book almost.
Yeah.
I would have to
consciously say, okay, I've got to go upstairs, put this record on the turntable, turn on the stereo. And it's funny because I have nice stereo equipment and all that there. And that used to be very important to me. But, you know, you get older, you have young kids and so on and around the house, and you just get busy, and you don't really sit down in front of a stereo anymore.
That's
you know?
What I'm worried about. I'm worried about seeing the shambles my attention span is in. If I got a few records, like I would put one record on, and I'd be like, oh, no, I'd just be almost sound like the sound of the needle scratching over the surface, my restlessness. My inability to concentrate.
Well, I think the medium forces you to act differently, because I think if you have a device in your hand, you can skip the song. You got your phone in your hand, you're just skipping through songs. You can do it because it's very convenient and easy to do. I think when you take the time to put a record on, mm-hmm. you're less likely to get up and physically pick up the tone arm and move it. It almost forces you a little bit to kind of sit back. And it's not like I sit at the couch with my hands folded and go, I am now listening to a record, side one. I have gone up there to write, and I'll sit with the computer in my lap and leave the record on,
right.
You know, playing while I'm typing, or, you know, I'm doing stuff for work on email, or even reading, stuff like that. So, you know, I will occasionally just throw a record on up there, just because, I don't have it in another format. But it's pretty rare. I would say maybe, you know, once a month I might get the urge to go.
That's actually pretty good.
Know? Yeah.
I miss the anticipation, silence crackle of the needle where it's... Mm-hmm.
And you then first put it down on the edge of the groove, and there's that deep...
Yeah.
As it catches the groove.
Yeah. And even when you
turn the volume up a little bit and you get ready for that first.
Then it just swells up. And it's almost like it's such a warm sound, and it seems like warmth out of this coldness, because before that you're not sure whether it can happen. But I even would know the crackle sounds in between tracks on records. I'd be familiar with the way that it would crackle as it would spin between tracks, or the beginning, you know, like it would have a boom, boom.
And certain pieces of vinyl would have different sound, and you'd get used to knowing, if you listen to that album enough, where the imperfections were.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
And even like there were some records that, I don't know what it was, but when they would get to the end of their side, they would slide the whatever was supposed to hold it in a sort of holding pattern, it wouldn't be there, and then the arm would just swing off.
Hit the label.
It would just go crazy. Yeah, and you'd hear, because it would be reading the label. You just knew your records in this. There was like this frail.
Did you have
medium?
Did you like clean the records? Like you put on the platter, and you take the like a brush, and you would clean off the.
I would use my arm.
You know,
if it was.
So you're very I got to be very anal retentive about cleaning my records.
You would spray it with record spray.
Well, I wouldn't spray it, but I had like this like anti-static kind of thing, and you'd hold it over the record, and it would sweep up all the dirt. You know, anything that got in
there. I didn't even know this. They had this.
Yeah, and you could, and then you could, and then I guess you could clean
them
and
stuff. And you were a kid with this? You were a kid like that?
Probably when I was a teenager, I got into that. I don't think I ever cleaned a record when I was a kid.
Because that sounds like the sort of thing like an old cool guy would do back in the 70s. I know, like, he sort of like the Burt Bacharach guy.
Just clean
his records.
Yeah,
with this
I would do it as a teenager because I thought that's what you did. Keep your records pristine.
It's very telling.
You know, and then with CDs, it was great because not only did it really sound big and clean, it was like you didn't have to worry about that anymore. You could just throw them in the case. You didn't have to do it. You could just throw it in the CD player. It was kind of a nice thing.
And then they did scratch, and you're like, what?
Well, they're not supposed to scratch.
Isn't that?
But they lie to us.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah. But even then, I would take care of my CDs. Like, I still have CDs from when I was in like high school and started. I still have a lot of those. Not all of them, but, and they still play fine. Like, I still have a lot of that stuff.
I have a question that's record player related. I don't know what a DJ does, and I mean I know what a DJ does, like a you know the guy spin records and stuff like that.
Like a club DJ.
Well, like famous DJs. Why is there a DJ Spooky? Why is he this highly sought after DJ?
He's like a millionaire. He makes like he'll make like $100,000 in a big appearance.
I know, but why
they're huge.
What's the magical part about it? Like I haven't gone to clubs and whatever in forever. But even if I read about DJ Spooky, isn't he just playing songs? Or I know he's manipulating and scratching.
It's the way they put it
stuff
all together. I don't know, because I've never, ever been any kind of animal to that scene. I'm being called. Who's calling me?
Maybe it's DJ Spooky. Tell him I'm not sure what he's doing.
Hello.
So we're going to have to let the question of what a DJ actually does, just let it be. They make a lot of money.
They make a lot of money. Records. Yeah. Tens of thousands of people will show up in a city for them.
What's the magic, though? Like, what are they doing that is so different from the other guy that's not making $100,000 a night?
I don't know. It's a complete mystery to me. They do something.
What? What is it?
And it's only a phenomenon like the major cities of the world. Like, I don't think you'd go to Cleveland and find like DJ Spooky. Like, you know what I mean? You'd have to go to New York or London or.
Well, that guy flies all over the place.
Yeah.
But is it like he's an incredibly cool guy and just having him at the center?
But the thing is, isn't it like you don't know much about them either? Like, there's no, like, you don't know who they are privately. Like, you wouldn't, like, that's another thing. They're anonymous. Like, you wouldn't walk down the street and say, oh, there's the famous DJ Spooky.
I can't draw one to mind.
Yeah. I don't even know if, like, people who care about, like, the point of it is almost they're faceless, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, there seems to be a part of it where there's some art to it that has a level of ability, kind of like the world of graffiti with Banksy at the top.
Mm-hmm.
They remind me of, like, that graffiti world.
Yeah.
And even, like, the anonymity of the graffiti world. Like, you know, Banksy doesn't want us to know who he is. And we don't know many graffiti artists. They're even well-known. We know Shepard Fairey because of the political thing. But
we're living in a world of the anonymous.
In a way, yeah. They sort of celebrate their own thing. And that's part of, like, their cachet, is that they're, you know, if you're going to be, you know, you have to include facelessness as on your resume. If you're going to be DJ Spooky, make the big dough and do the magic you do. But I'd like to find out.
It isn't. It's a whole new, like, underworld. I don't know anything about it. It's a whole other separate universe from.
I would like to become really good at it. I have one record player. Now all I need is like two records. And then the magic will happen.
I think you need some other. There's other devices. They have all kinds of computer.
I don't like
stuff.
That. They have like fake turntables up there.
Yeah,
that hook up to CDs and
stuff,
iTunes,
and they'll sample stuff as they're going along. I would think that there's a whole, because everything you see is always the DJ in silhouette, but there's always like a screen, and he's always like working on some kind of. He's got MacBooks and he's got turntables and he's got all kinds of like effects boxes. I don't know what they're doing up there.
We should do a show where we try to figure out, like, we do a really good DJ show where we get all of our gear together and we come up with what we think that DJs do and we just put it out there.
It would just be awful.
No. Can you imagine us? It'll be like one song ends and before it completely ends, we start another one.
Right.
And then I'll also scratch a noise.
Scratch a little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
And then it's like the money starts rolling.
Right.
Nobody knows who we are, but we're making big money.
Oh, that's an idea. We could do that.
DJ Banksy. I would try to be like crossing over, like referencing him. Okay, I'm going to ask you these questions because all right. Otherwise never. So these are questions. This first one has a follow-up. What was the name of your first grade girlfriend? If you did not have one, what should her name have been? Maybe you had one. Did anybody in your first grade class?
Yeah, it was. Her name was Sarah.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was she officially your girlfriend?
Well, it's like I knew her in kindergarten and first grade, I think. Maybe even later than that. And she lived like down the block. So like we kind of knew each other. Obviously it wasn't a girlfriend, but I remember specifically she had red hair. Yeah.
What a sweet story.
Yeah. Sweet on her, I remember.
That people were sweet on each other back then, but you couldn't do anything about it or name it, or you couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it was any. You couldn't call it infatuation or anything. It was just.
Could you talk to her, or were you? Did you?
Played and stuff with other kids and stuff. It wasn't, but I don't think. You know, it's not like we were walked around holding hands at the slide, you know.
But I
remember specifically thinking. Like that was, you know, she would be.
She's your special one.
She would be that special girl kind of thing. But it was very, I don't think it lasted very, you know, that kind of infatuation.
Was she still in your grade school when you got to sixth grade, or was she gone by then?
No, I don't think she was there by then. I can't remember her after first or second grade. You know how memories from that age are very vague.
Yeah.
So what about you?
No, no.
You didn't have any kind of.
No, gosh, no.
No?
No, barely even in through high school, no.
Really?
Yeah. I even now, I don't know.
Sure, Lois will be happy to hear that.
I had a very strange, isolated
childhood
where it's taken me a long time to make my way from the forest to the city, from, you know, my self to, you know, bringing myself and my belongings to the campfire where the other people are.
Really?
Yeah.
You're still hanging out in the cave?
A little bit. I don't know why that was, but something happened when I was young that prevented, I mean, I almost felt like I was like a ghost. Like no one could see me.
Mm-hmm.
I had this very powerful sense, and which is strange because I was really good at sports. And so, obviously, people did see me.
Did you have close friends? I mean, did you have one or two particular?
Not until high school.
Kids? Yeah.
And then I had a close friend named Lonnie Murray. But when I was there was a kid that lived near me, Adrian, when I was grade school, but he was kind of mean to me. He wasn't really a friend. He would sometimes play with me if it was convenient for him, if there weren't better people around. So I didn't have a very good sense of my friendship with him, and I didn't really get much in the way of what a friend might provide. Right. It was more like every once in a while somebody would, run around and with me and
kick
throw
a
rocks.
Ball with you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a positive experience, really, at the bottom of it.
But none of your teammates, you played sports, right?
So yeah, but it was so set in stone by the time, It's just kind of like there weren't any other kids around, and I didn't have that bonding experience with anybody. So there was just something that kind of was broken for me, and I've been like moving towards the world ever since. But I'm aware of that as like a strange
patterns like that get set at such an age.
Yeah,
really do perpetuate for. It's just the waves that move out forever. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
if you're somebody who was kind of exposed to a lot of friends and had a lot of kids around you, I think, at a young age, you kind of tend to hold on to that a little bit. But I think you've got that pattern where it's like, well, you kind of, in your own, your circle is not touching their circle. It just kind of continues for a long time.
Yeah, I became very guarded, very protective of my world. You know, it's sort of like, I had the sense that the world couldn't quite see me, so I just created my own world that I lived in. And, you know, everything for my life has been shaped by that. So I'm still like I'm still trying to blend myself back into the world so that I can function in a realistic manner. It's almost like the world was autistic for me, and I wasn't. But I had to, and so now I'm trying to break down this this artificial autism that the world seemed to have so that I can enter it and be like, hey, you know what I do? I like to write and I like to do music and radio. Is that okay if I join you? Mm-hmm. Which is sort of how I feel.
Don't you think any kind of performer on any level, though, has a little bit of that somewhere?
Probably. Yeah, maybe that's the draw. Maybe that's what's pulling is, again, to use that campfire concept, like this desire to belong and not exactly sure how to make it happen. I'm writing stories so that I can be with people.
Yeah, I think that totally makes sense. I think that's I think, a very typical story for performance, for any performer.
That's good to know.
And by performer, I mean anybody, from a writer to an actor to whatever, any kind of artistic endeavor. I think what you're doing is you are trying to find your tribe in some way or trying to connect with a tribe. That's what you're doing. You're trying to put something out there and kind of communicate in some way. That's your way of doing it. There are some people who just were extroverts from the beginning. And you know those kids,
Yeah.
And I had a couple of very close friends growing up. I didn't have a lot. Like you, I think I had my own little circle, although it included a couple of kids. But I think you knew those extroverts from a very young age. The guys who were gonna be, you know, the captain of the football team kind of stereotype, or the guys who were going to be, the president of the class come, junior year. That you knew certain people were going to be that way. And you just knew, it's not me. It's not going to be. Right. I'm not going to be in that circle,
right.
And I'm going to be in my own little thing here, and I can build my own thing. But there's a way that I can find others that are kind of like me. Maybe I can join the drama club. Maybe I can, work in the AV squad. Whatever it might be, you find your little niche.
If I could go back in time,
and you just did it later on. You just did.
I'm still.
You just did it 40 years on.
It's still. I'm trying. Still, it's an effort. Because, I have this built-in sense of retreating onto, my private world. I have to try to fight against that.
Do you find yourself dissatisfied with that retreat, or do you enjoy it?
Well, it's comfortable, and it's sort of my home. It means that I can spend long periods of time by myself and not feel bad or feel lonely.
But when you are alone or you are by yourself, do you feel satisfied with that? You're happy with that?
Well, to a certain level, although it doesn't, after a while, it doesn't feel very healthy. And I feel like I should have more human interaction with other people. Like I should be more, I think I enjoy it. I mean, it's not like I'm with you and I enjoy this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's nourishing for me. But it's also, it's hard for me to do it, even if it's simple.
It's not necessarily in your nature.
Well, I think it is in my nature, but I think I learned that it wasn't, dysfunctionally learned that it wasn't. And I'm still breaking that down because I still innately don't believe the world can see me or wants me to be around. So I'm
always... That's sad. that's kind of a sad feeling. That's a sad sentiment.
Well,
because obviously there are people that want you.
Well, I don't know. I think I may forever doubt that. That may be just... But it's not like I'm crying or sad about it. It feels like an old thing I'm trying to work out.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm going to have to start charging you $105 an hour for this kind of...
These are supposed to be questions for you, not me.
I'm going to ask you to lie back. I'm going to write a little prescription. Well, you're going to talk a little bit about your mom.
I would love a prescription.
And then we'll talk... Did you ever lose a dog? You must have... Did you lose a pet? What happened to you? So did someone take a toy? No, I don't mean to... I'm making fun of you because it's... That's just a natural instinct of...
You shouldn't make fun of me. I'm ridiculous.
No, not at all. But you know what it is? That moment, you just feel a little uncomfortable. Oh, and I feel like I want to protect you on tape. Like I don't want you revealing too much if you would feel uncomfortable.
Well, we can erase that. Okay, question two. Have you ever thought about or purchased a really good blender, toaster, or other appliance where it's not even something that you might use, but you decided, you just started researching it, and you decided and determined what the best little thing was, and you bought it. Now, these questions don't have any value. These are valueless questions that I wrote up.
That's what I like about them. You know what? I really like my toaster, and I think we did consider the toaster.
What is your toaster?
I don't remember anymore. I bought it, you know, at a department like a Sears or a Target or something. I don't know. What I like about it is I wanted to buy one of those really like Art Deco-looking toasters.
Oh, yeah.
But they're very expensive.
Like a diner?
Yeah.
Type toaster?
Like, the kind of stainless steel. They have different colors and stuff and the rounded, but they're very expensive. I remember when we first redid our kitchen. So we wanted something that could toast like bagels and lots of bread. Like you had the four slots at the top.
Oh, yeah.
And you had different settings for each side. Very, very, and so we got one of those. It's not the Art Deco style, but it's got all that technology. And it's a very, like, it didn't cost a lot of money, but it does an awful lot.
Mm.
And it's, like, really easy to clean, and it looks good on the counter. And I really like my toaster.
Right.
I do. I really like my toaster. If you want, yeah. So if you wanted, that would probably be it. I never bought a blender. I think we have one, but I don't remember buying it.
You really have to want to blend.
I'd have to go find it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's under the thing.
Like it's in the counter. It's under the counter somewhere in a cabinet. Right. I don't.
But sometimes you wonder. You're like, what are blenders for? And you because
you have a blender.
We do. Yeah, but it's just the regular. You know, almost looks like it's. Whenever I see my blender, I feel like I'm possibly at a garage sale. Like it's not ours.
Like it was from 1968.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
Like maybe they were used more during the cocktail hour of the 60s.
I remember my parents always having a blender.
Ice and drinks. And
yeah.
Stuff. Yeah. But nowadays, unless you're going to go on a health kick and start eating
doing smoothies
fruits,
or something. Yeah. I wouldn't. That's funny. But I do. Now that you mention it, I've never thought of this before. And all the years I've had this particular toaster, I really like my toaster.
I'm so glad I asked that question. I thought it was going to be a dud.
No, I
thought
really
it was going to be stony silence.
I might go home now.
I want
and
some toast.
Something like I'm going to find a big, thick piece of bread that shouldn't fit because it's an extra wide part of that toaster.
Mm.
And I'm going to toast it,
mm.
And I'm going to put some I'll put something on it.
Oh, butter.
I'll put some cheese and some maybe I'll find some garlic. I'll do it up because I can.
I find
that toaster can do what no other toaster can do.
it sounds like it's a really good toaster.
I think it is a good toaster. And it toasts just, it can set the temperature, and it's just precise.
I can picture
it. It's very precise. I like the fact that it toasts consistently. Like every time when I set it to that, I know it's going to pop up the way I want it.
What a great toaster.
I like this toaster. I may go home and look at it. I'm going to go home and look at my toaster.
Oh, if you were driving down the highway and late for a meeting, and you could swear by God that you saw a $100 bill blow past your windshield, would you pull to the side of the road and try to find it? It's a $100 bill.
Yeah, probably.
And
I'm not one for punctual meetings anyway.
And this is a highway, too. It's a little dangerous.
Huh. If I thought I could do it, I probably would. If I thought the bill was just going to blow off on the wind and be in lane number four.
So if you felt like the thing was still, like, just based on how it blew across your windshield, how likely it was you could get it?
I would certainly take a second look, okay. Wouldn't you?
I was down in Georgia once, and I actually drove over a $20 bill on the highway, what I thought was a $20 bill, and I did pull over. It was pretty.
You could tell it was a $20 bill as you drove over it?
I thought it was, yeah.
Maybe based on the
you know,
the
I
bump.
Think money has such, I mean... It's such a strong symbol in our brains. I think we can identify money really we just can grab it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the shape of it, the color of it. I thought it was a $20 bill. I didn't think it was a one. You know, it felt it had more going on inside it.
I did.
I pulled over and I realized it's one of those things where, you know, you're going 50, 60 miles an hour. And I never was a fast motorcycle driver. You realize how much distance you've... So I pull over, and I start walking back, and I realize
like
I don't know
yards.
If I have to go like a half a mile walking back. Like, where's my area?
This is on the highway?
Yeah. I had no reference. And so I just kind of stood there for a while waiting to see if this little leaf object would pick up from the highway to give me some reference. But, that was it. And then from then on, I decided if that ever happens to me again, just keep going. Even if it's a $100 bill, because you won't be able to find it. You'd be as likely finding a $100 bill wherever you're looking, because it's just gone.
So are we the lamplighters?
We are so far.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that goes along with the pea shooters. I mean, in some ways, that's like before we had lamps mm-hmm. that you could just press the button. You have to have a guy go up on a stepladder that he probably carried on his back. And he'd light it, and then at the end of the day, he'd come back and
snuff it out.
Whew, yeah. And that's how it feels like we are. We're like that. Machine breakers, pea shooters, we're lamplighters. A little brighter wherever he would go. The old lamplighter of long, long ago. His snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow. The old lamplighter of long, long ago. You'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile had a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter wherever he. The old lamplighter of long, long ago. Now if you look up in the sky, you'll understand the reason why the little stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here. He turns them off when dawn is near. The little man we loved of long ago. He made the night a little brighter wherever.